This Week in Nuclear, episode number 44, May 9th, 2007. Welcome to episode 44 of This Week in Nuclear. I'm your host, John Wheeler, bringing you news, facts, and commentary on how nuclear energy will make our world cleaner, safer, and less dependent on fossil fuels. As I was looking through the news this week, I couldn't help but notice the strong political undertones in virtually every story. Nuclear energy is always a hot topic in the media, but the technology and the issues surrounding it are not always accurately portrayed. Nuclear energy's safe operating record, emissions-free electricity, and relative price stability have created a resurgence in public support. That in turn is causing the anti-nuclear groups to shift into high gear, and they're experts at using the political system to place legal and financial barriers in the path of nuclear plant operators. As you listen to the news this week, keep that thought in the back of your mind and you'll see what I mean. The nuclear debate continues to churn in Australia. This past week, Prime Minister John Howard told a Liberal Party conference that the 1999 law that bans nuclear power station in Australia and limits uranium mining is, quote, no longer compatible with the need to act on climate change. He also said that Australia needs to wind down its reliance on coal-fired power stations and adopt nuclear power generation. Those are some of the strongest words we've heard out of John Howard in support of nuclear power plants. I've mentioned before that Australia has about one-third of the world's known easily recoverable uranium, but they don't refine any of it. They mine the ore and ship it to other countries to refine into usable fuel. They have only one reactor, one at Lucas Heights, and it's used for research and for medical isotope production. You might wonder why a nation with such a valuable resource would be missing out on this fabulous opportunity. Well, the answer is very simple, and all you need to do is follow the money and the political power. Along with uranium, Australia has abundant coal, and they generate almost all of their electricity from coal. The coal industry in Australia has huge financial resources and even greater political clout. And the coal industry views nuclear energy as a direct challenge to their energy monopoly and their cash flow. So it's no surprise that the biggest opposition to John Howard's plan to refine uranium into fuel and to build nuclear power plants is coming from the regions with heavy ties to the coal industry. For example, last year, Queensland Premier Peter Beattie supported the passage of a law in that state. It's called the Nuclear Facilities Prohibition Act of 2006. It's just what it sounds like. It's a law that prevents nuclear plants or uranium enrichment facilities from being built anywhere in Queensland, even if the Australian federal government removes legal obstacles. Queensland just happens to be one of the two largest coal-producing states in Australia. You might recall an earlier story that I discussed in which the mayor of Townsville in Queensland complained that nuclear plants are not welcome there because they would hurt the tourist industry and might harm the Great Barrier Reef. Well, you guessed it, Townsville is right on the edge of the largest coal mining region in the state, and much of their income and political contributions, no doubt, are derived from the coal industry. This new anti-nuclear law in Queensland went into effect this week, and the Queensland Mines and Energy Minister Jeff Wilson celebrated the occasion and was quoted as saying, "The Act bans nuclear facilities in Queensland in order to protect the health, safety, and well-being of each and every one of us," unquote. He also said there is no need for Queensland to go down the path of nuclear power plants when we don't need to. Here in Queensland, we have abundant access to long-term supplies of coal and gas, and we're confident that clean coal technology will provide a similar level of greenhouse abatement to that of nuclear energy, and in a shorter time frame. Man, I wonder what clean coal he's talking about. there's still no economical way to remove CO2 from coal plant exhaust. And if he's talking about sequestering the carbon on a large scale, that won't be available for many years, if ever. It's still more of a theory than anything else. So the stage is set for a showdown between the Australian states and the federal government over the future of their energy supply. On one side, you have the national policy of reducing reliance on coal and improving air quality and on limiting CO2 gas emissions. In the other corner, you have interests protecting the coal lobby. This will be a good one to watch play out. I haven't talked about Iran in quite some time. There's been a lot of political haggling and media attention, but in reality, there's been almost no change in the positions in the standoff between Iran and the rest of the world over their renegade uranium enrichment program. More than a year has passed since the dispute first made it to the United Nations Security Council, and the two positions are virtually unchanged. Iran's President Ahmadinejad continues to proclaim their right to enrich uranium for energy production. The International Atomic Energy Agency continues to ask for transparency and for Iran to stop enriching uranium because of fears that they're developing nuclear weapons. Iran continues to install more and more centrifuges to increase their enrichment capacity in violation of United Nations orders. And while Iran has allowed some limited IAEA inspections, they refuse to stop the enrichment process. The UN did impose some sanctions, but they really don't mean too much. A couple of months ago, there was an interesting development when Russia refused to deliver fuel to Iran for the first core load of the Bushehr nuclear plant because Iran had failed to make payments owed to Russia. That little squabble poured some cold water on the otherwise very cozy relationship between Russia and Iran, and it was interesting to watch Moscow's posture with Iran toughen when the dispute was in full swing. I heard that the contract required payment in U.S. dollars, but Iran tried to pay in another form of currency and the Russians refused. There's some speculation that Iran is mishandling their cash flow and they didn't have the dollars to pay. And in a sign that there's continued internal political dissatisfaction over Ahmadinejad's policies, last week police in Iran arrested Hossein Mousavian, the country's former nuclear negotiator. He was hauled off to prison for a, quote, interrogation, and the Iranian newspapers report that he could face an espionage charge. Mousavian is an ally of the former Iranian president Rafsanjani, who remains a political adversary of Ahmadinejad. Rafsanjani has maintained a more moderate stance towards the international community over Tehran's nuclear program. Mousavian was a member of the Iranian nuclear negotiating team until 2005. When Ahmadinejad defeated Rafsanjani, he replaced the entire nuclear negotiating team, including Mousavian. There's some speculation that Ahmadinejad is attempting to eliminate anyone within Iran who might question his hardline positions. And Mousavian is certainly someone with the knowledge and the experience to speak intelligently about Iran's nuclear position in international relations. In another story, an Iranian-born engineer who worked at Palo Verde Nuclear Plant in Arizona for 16 years was arrested by U.S. federal agents last week as he got off an airplane having just returned from Iran. Mohammed Alavi, who is a U.S. citizen, has been charged with violating the trade embargo that prohibits Americans from exporting goods or services to Iran. If convicted, he could face up to 21 months in prison. While there are not many details of exactly what Mr. Alavi did, it involved taking nuclear plant training software and computer access codes with him to Iran, and in October, the authorities allege, the software was used to download training materials from Tehran using Palo Verde user credentials. The FBI said there's no indication that the training software had any terrorist connections, and there's no evidence to suggest the software access was linked to the Iranian government. According to court records, the software is used only for training plant employees, but it did allow users to access details on the Palo Verde control room and plant layout. Officials in Arizona Public Service Company, the Phoenix-based utility that operates Palo Verde, said the software does not pose a security risk because it doesn't control any of the plant's nuclear operating systems. That makes perfect sense to me because designs for plants like Palo Verde are not secret. It's a little bit oversimplified, though. The security systems and procedures would be safeguarded and would not be available in that sort of software. Nonetheless, the utility said it's changed the software procedures. The USA and India nuclear cooperation deal is close to being approved. The two sides have been negotiating for the last several months, and reports indicate that most issues have been resolved. Later this month, Nicholas Burns, the U.S. Undersecretary for Political Affairs, is scheduled to travel to New Delhi in hopes that he'll be able to finalize and sign the agreement. There's recognition in both the U.S. and in India that with the U.S. presidential elections nearing, they need to get this issue resolved and on the books soon. The deal is set to go into effect in 2008 and will open the door for cooperation between the two nations in developing nuclear power plants and civilian nuclear energy-related industries. Japan and the USA have formed the first international agreement under the GNEP, or Global Nuclear Energy Partnership. The two nations will work jointly on reactor designs and new fuel types for Generation 4 reactors that might be built around the world. Assistant Energy Secretary Dennis Spurgeon said that 222 reactors are planned for construction under the GNEP program. Interestingly enough, some elected officials in the new democratically controlled Congress are of the opinion that GNEP was kicked off without sufficient congressional oversight. I wonder what that means. Well, here's an example. Jeff Bingaman, the new chairman of the Senate Energy Committee, stated that he is, quote, looking forward to having the Energy Committee review the program. Well, I thought the program was already underway. Bingaman took the reins of the committee from Senator Pete Domenici, who is a strong supporter of nuclear energy. So here's a classic example of how a change in the political party in power and the subsequent change in committee leadership can cause the previously approved programs to be dragged back into the legislative process. It gives a new party in power the opportunity to weigh in on the policy and to attach their pork barrels to the programs. It's also an example of how shifting political winds create the environment of legislative uncertainty that makes investors second-guess making long-term investments. The Global Nuclear Energy Partnership will reduce the amount of used nuclear fuel that has to be stored in the United States because the used fuel would be reprocessed and reburned in the modern reactors. The new design will be proliferation resistant, so concerns over diversion of the nuclear fuel for weapons would be addressed. Critics say that the GNEP program is being invented as it moves along. I've got a little different opinion. Isn't that always the way it is when you're dealing with cutting-edge technologies? You rarely have all the questions answered when you start. You have a vision, and you have the smart people working on it to fill in the gaps as you go. If engineers and technicians used the same logic when building and growing the internet, we'd still be using 28K dial-up modems. The new governor of New York State, Elliot Spitzer, is flip-flopping his position on Indian Point nuclear plant. When Spitzer campaigned for governor, he promised to shut down Indian Point. I guess reality has set in, as often happens. He knows that without Indian Point, New York State can't avoid skyrocketing electricity prices. They already have the highest costs in the nation. And they can't meet greenhouse gas reduction goals. Even more importantly, they'd be unable to prevent summer blackouts. But that doesn't mean he's going to completely forget the promises he made to the anti-nuclear radicals who got him elected. This past week, he joined Senator Hillary Clinton in calling for an independent safety assessment of Indian Point. He stated that there are two reasons that an independent safety assessment is needed. First of all, he said that Indian Point was late installing emergency sirens with backup power. And secondly, because of groundwater leaks from the fuel storage pool at the site. And I want to explain why Spitzer's logic is flawed. First of all, neither of the issues he cited has any safety significance at all. I've talked about the fuel storage pool leak before. It has zero safety significance. Radiation can be measured at extremely low levels. Let me give you an example. The average person in the United States gets about 350 millirem per year of natural background radiation. And according to the NRC website, if your house was sitting on the edge of the Indian Point site and you lived there 24 hours a day, 365 days a year, and the plant was releasing radiation at the legal limit, which they're not, you'd get 6 more millirem. So let me go over those numbers again. 350 millirem per year from natural background radiation, and 6 more if Indian Point was releasing at its maximum legal limit, which it's not. The minute amount of leakage from Indian Point is far less than the legal limit, several orders of magnitude. So in reality, maybe you'd get 1 more millirem per year out of 350. By comparison, 1 dental x-ray gives about 3 millirems. And you wouldn't think twice about getting 2 or 3 x-rays if you had a toothache. So what kind of safety significance is that? On the issue of the battery backup for Indian Point siren systems, you might remember some discussion I had about this on a prior show. No other plant in the United States is required to have battery backups for their emergency sirens. Hillary Clinton managed to get this added to the Energy Policy Act of 2005 to appease her anti-nuclear supporters. Having a battery backup to emergency sirens may make them less likely to fail in some very low probability off-the-wall situations, but it does not add appreciably to public safety. If it did, it would be part of federal law, and it would be required of all nuclear plants in the U.S. And it's not. Indian Point was just fined $130,000 for being late implementing this new requirement. Even though there's no safety value added, and even though they began installation of the project voluntarily well before Hillary succeeded in making it a legal requirement. So back to the original issue, Spitzer and Hillary both know the state of New York cannot survive without Indian Point, but they're going to do everything they can to increase the cost of power they generate, and they'll use the plant as a favorite target when they want to show how much they care about their voters. Since I'm on a roll talking about politicians making special rules for nuclear plants, I need to mention what's going on in Vermont. This past Tuesday, the Vermont Senate approved a bill that would levy a special $37 million tax on Vermont Yankee Nuclear Plant in order to fund a statewide energy efficiency program. That might not seem like a lot, but just last year, Vermont Yankee agreed to contribute $25 million to a clean energy fund in exchange for state approval for a 20% power uprate. Now some lawmakers in Vermont are taking the position that because the plant's making good profits, the state should take a larger share. Do you think they'd be making the same argument if it was a computer factory, a dairy farm, or a sawmill? Doesn't it seem against the whole concept of a free market and capitalism to ask for more taxes just because a company does a good job and is making a greater return on their investment? Vermont Yankee will already pay more in income tax if they make higher revenues, so this is in effect a tax on top of a tax. Vermont Yankee is fighting the proposed tax increase because the state is reneging on a deal they made just a year ago. Vermont enjoys some of the lowest electricity rates in the nation, has the lowest greenhouse gas emissions of any state, and it's for one reason and one reason only, Vermont Yankee Nuclear Plant. It's ironic to me that the same politicians who claim to be so interested in preventing climate change and protecting the ratepayers are the same ones who are trying to tax their nuclear plant out of business. On a brighter note, this week Unistar, the joint venture between Constellation Energy and Areva, announced that they've selected the Calvert Cliffs site in Maryland as the location for their first new nuclear plant, which will be an EPR. They notified the NRC that they'll be applying for a construction and operating license for the new unit, and that'll be the third reactor at that site. Unistar has also discussed the possibility of adding a new unit at their 9 Mile site in New York, but with Elliot Spitzer at the helm of that state, it's unlikely. There's a legal battle being waged between the state of New Jersey and the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission over the Oyster Creek nuclear plant, who is applying for a license extension. The outcome of the battle could have ramifications for the entire U.S. industry. Oyster Creek is applying for a 20-year license extension, something that 48 other nuclear plants have already been granted in the USA. Recently, the state argued that the NRC should consider the possible impact of a terrorist attack on the plant prior to granting the life extension. The NRC considered the state's request after a thorough review concluded that New Jersey's concerns are speculative and theoretical, and the potential terrorist attacks are already addressed in the day-to-day oversight of the facility. Needless to say, the state didn't like the commission's ruling. Last Wednesday, the New Jersey State Attorney General Stuart Rabner filed a petition in the Federal Third Circuit Court of Appeals to challenge the ruling. This is yet another example of how anti-nuclear politicians use the legal system in an attempt to block nuclear plants from operating, or in the least try to raise costs by imposing more requirements, more evaluations, more legal fees. This is a similar approach that was taken earlier this year in California, where anti-nuclear groups succeeded in forcing the NRC to consider terrorist attacks at Diablo Canyon, who was applying for a license for a dry cask fuel storage facility. If New Jersey wins the appeal, then the same case could be made in more than 30 other license renewals that are either underway or expected to be applied for in the next few years. It does mean that the license extensions might be lengthier and more costly. As you would expect, the Sierra Club celebrated New Jersey's decision to appeal. And finally, last Monday, the U.S. Supreme Court acted to uphold Environmental Protection Agency rules that require aging coal-powered electricity plants in the U.S. to install pollution controls when they do extensive upgrades. I'm probably oversimplifying this a bit, but the issue is this. The Clean Air Act in the United States requires new coal plants to include pollution controls. The law also mandates that old plants have to install similar equipment if owners decide to do major upgrades to existing plants. This aspect of the law is designed to prevent owners of older, dirtier coal plants from choosing to indefinitely upgrade and refurbish them in order to keep them running in lieu of building newer, cleaner plants. There's also a provision from 2003 called the New Source Rule that allowed some older plants to be upgraded without installing pollution controls. Going back more than 10 years, there are cases being argued between utilities and the EPA over whether or not specific plant upgrades or modifications should have included pollution controls. In a nutshell, the ruling this week stated that the New Source Rule was so lenient that it violated the Clean Air Act. Because of the new ruling, it'll be much more difficult in the future for old coal plants to continue running indefinitely without installing pollution controls. That was the whole intent of the Clean Air Act, so it seems like the Supreme Court got us back on track. And by closing this loophole in EPA rules, the court has made it more difficult for older coal plants to keep running. That means new power plants will have to be built to replace them. It also provides more incentive for emissions-free electricity sources, such as nuclear energy. I've talked a lot about the demand for new talent in the nuclear industry and how nuclear technology and engineering offers fantastic careers and high-paying jobs. The Department of Energy is working to generate interest in nuclear careers, and they released an informational video that targets young people. If you go to my website at thisweekinnuclear.com, you can review a copy of the video, and in my next show, I'll cover it in some more detail. Well, that's about it for the news this week. I think you'll agree that it was quite a political roundup. Thanks for listening to This Week in Nuclear. This is John Wheeler, wishing you well. Go green, go nuclear, and have a great week.